Welcome to the Sum of It All Unlearning Podcast. I'm Audra Mendeville, along with my colleague Mark Alcorn from the San Diego County Office of Education. And this season, we're diving into the book Unlearning, Changing Your Beliefs and Your Classroom with UDL by Allison Posey and Katie Novak. Transcripts to our podcast are always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform. This week, we're diving into Chapter 1, Apples and Buffets.
Yes, quite a title. And the authors start with an example about apples. And Audrey, you might recall in the chapter, they start off with this fact that when there is no light, there is no color. Shout out to our science colleagues on that, right? And however, in some of the experiments that scientists have done, individuals have been placed in a completely dark room, a room where absolutely no light can enter, and they still claim to be able to see an apple as being red. Like they claim that they can see that color red. And I appreciate this example that the authors start the chapter with, in the sense that it can be hard to unlearn something. And they say more about this. They say that new learning and change takes energy and deliberate effort, requiring that we build new models of understanding and change what we perceive and how we act. And, you know, this whole idea of sticking to the old habit and routine, even when it contradicts what we know to be true, like the apple, right? You can't see the apple, but people still claim to be able to see the color red. I'm struck by the statement, contradicts what we know to be true. Gosh, I'm thinking of examples of this that might have happened in my own life of education. Could I possibly have been doing something that contradicts what I actually know to be true? And if so, why would I keep doing those things? And what would these things be? And especially about teaching and learning mathematics.
It's a great question, Mark. I think this is something we've been trying to kind of unpack over the last few episodes for sure. Actually, maybe over the whole series of this podcast. Is that, you know, there's a quote there on page 3. It says, based on our years of experience, both as learners and as educators, we fall back on patterns and methods that may not reflect on our current understanding of research, of learning, and the brain. It's as though we get into the context of the classroom and fall into the routines of the teacher as one who delivers information to students. I mean, that's a strong pull. I mean, you see it.
Yeah.
I just think about it with staff meetings. Like, you can see teachers walk in and be and act and live as students, right? You see them slump into their chairs, right? We've all done it, right? We have this understanding of what's expected of us as the one to receive information or the learner in that situation. In the same way that when we walk into the classroom, I think as the teacher, we can't even explain it because it's so stuck in our unconscious brain of what we expect our behaviors to be and how we expect students to react to that.
Yeah, I can think of a quick example, Audrey. One of the things I used to say is to my colleague, to say, you know, when we were having a discussion, you know, and even I had convinced myself that my students and I were having a discussion, but it wasn't. I was just talking stuff.
See, that's a perfect example. We're like, we were having a discussion. You're like, no,
we weren't.
No, we weren't.
But I completely contradicted myself. But I had actually fooled myself into thinking that it just
it happens in the math classroom. It happens in the math classroom.
For sure. And you know the statement on page 5, Audrey, about UDL is not just about offering choices. So glad to see that statement. You and I have discussed this idea of, you know, when we're implementing UDL in the classroom, about, you know, many times it can look like just this explosion of menus for every assignment. Versus the idea of intentional choices. The authors talk about intentional choices that are specifically designed to reduce barriers for students to engage in learning that works toward a specific learning goal. So that, you know, the choices should be the options and opportunities that we provide that allow each and every student to progress toward the same learning goal rather than only certain students getting that opportunity.
Yeah, I think it's a great point, Mark. I appreciate you said this. We've said this time and time again. It's not about choice for choice sake. When we talk about this idea of UDL and choice, this is where this buffet analogy gets introduced in the chapter. And they talk about this di UDL design encourages this subtle but profound shift that each diner is able to make a choice based on a goal. Like the goal is super important, right? And they continue and say, we need to start to support students to become expert consumers and to build more of a community of collaboration around high-level goal-directed eating. And I think this is where we're getting kind of started with this is like, it's not about opening your refrigerator or saying like, please, everyone, you can pick whatever you want from the supermarket today. Like, it's not about saying you have just choice for choice sake. It's about saying my goal is to feed everyone something delicious that makes them satisfied, that helps them feel balanced, that whatever those things are that you think of in your buffet analogy here. And then based on that, as the person setting it up, I'm going to make some choices about what goes on the table so that my diners have choices.
Right, for sure. But Audrey, I love how the authors, they bring up a yeah, but, right? Because a lot of times as educators, we push back and we get concerned and we say, wait a second, students may not make good choices. Wait a minute, students are going to be overwhelmed by all these choices and frozen into like being able to do anything. And when I was reading that, I was thinking of a colleague that I have. That's a kindergarten teacher that I had the privilege of working with. Shout out to my kindergarten teacher colleague. She won't let me say her name, but she knows who she is. And this colleague of mine, when she would present a math story to her class, the students would then go off on their own in small groups to make meaning of the story and work together to solve the problem. And the way it worked in her classroom, there would be throughout the room, scattered about, there were all these storage containers that had a different manipulative, a different tool in each of the storage containers. And the students would talk together, which is awesome watching kindergartners have these conversations, talk together about like which tool they should go get, which tub they should go get and bring back to their group to solve that problem. And the reason the story reminds me of this chapter is she let them go make whatever choice they made, and they had to think about like whether that ended up working out for them. And I just think that was so cool. It wasn't like she said, for this problem, you should use this tool. The idea of S&P number five, use appropriate tools strategically. I just thought she was teaching these very young children the idea that they might bump into something that doesn't work, and that's part of the learning process. So I think this idea of choices, the notion that our kids may make the wrong choice, actually can be a good thing.
I really appreciate that, Mark. I appreciate it for a couple of reasons, but one links into this statement that I wanted to bring up and that follows that section and talks about like how the UDL approach recognizes that within each lesson, preferences will vary based on different factors. And so what you're bringing up is for me is this idea that like in this story problem, the bears make the most sense for me. We're gonna go grab the bears, but that doesn't mean that every time I'm gonna go grab the bears. Like that would be a bad strategy, right? And so having that like moment of saying like, why did this work for this problem or why did this not work is critical. In the same way that like we get into this almost like labeling factor, like, and it happens with meals. And I think that's why the analogy is so strong here. Like if I looked up and I said, oh, look, I noticed that Mark had a salad today. So next time he comes over to my house, I'm going to get him a salad. And then the next time another salad and another salad and another salad. And Mark's like,
Oh
whoa, like,
no.
I'm down for a salad here and there, but like, that's not my go-to favorite meal, right? I picked it that day because I was planning to run after work, or I picked it that day because I'd had a really heavy breakfast, right? Like the context of the day matters. Just like in math, the context of the problem matters. The context of like And the lesson design, the context of where the students are at in the day. That's why first period, the lessons don't work the same way they work in third period. And yet we treat them like they should. We treat them like they're the same exact thing happening over and over again. And we're like, gosh, my lessons never work for first and they never work for the after lunch crowd. It's like, yeah, the context changes things. You're going to need a different thing to engage kids first thing in the morning, and you're going to need something else to bring kids into the classroom after lunch, right? And we know this to be true, and yet we still design one size fits all, right?
And gosh, Audrey, this reminds me of the notion of learning styles, where we
Yeah.
get into this fixed assignment, right? This is where we really got off track as educators, I think. And the authors remind us of this, that learning styles has been debunked. Context matters for my learning preferences, as you pointed out so well. But in the past, we might have said, and I might have said, hey, this student is visual, so let's give this student visuals nonstop. In a way, it's kind of almost like a different kind of labeling, really.
Yeah, it's exactly that. And I wonder sometimes I like kind of try to dive into like, why do we get into that? Like, why? Just because it worked today doesn't mean it's always going to work, but why do we keep thinking it's going to do that? And I think as educators, it feels good to do something that's successful for students. So when I plan a lesson and I see kids who are having difficulty succeed, I see the majority of my class get to the end of the lesson and achieve the learning goals. That feels good, right? And so, and I forget if it's dopamine. It's something that hits in our brains, right? I know enough of brain research to be really dangerous,
Interesting.
not dangerous, make mistakes. So people can write in and tell us what I'm missing here. But like, I know that what there's chemicals in our brains that make us want to do that again and again because feeling successful feels good. And so we try to then recreate those exact same scenarios, which leads us into the path of like, what did I do that made it right? Well, I gave Mark visuals. So I'm going to give Mark more visuals, right? Like, I really think it comes
True.
almost from like a natural, I think that's my theory. I have nothing to go behind it beyond like, I think there's something there that makes us feel like that's the equation. If I do this, then I'm going to get this. But we're totally neglecting the fact that context and variability mean that there's more than one way that you or any other learner is going to find success. It totally limits that, right? Which is the problem because not only do we get bored of seeing visuals over and over again, but we pigeonhole kids into spaces that's dangerous.
And we're leaving them out of the conversation, right? Like that, we're
Totally.
not allowing them to start making those decisions of what makes the most sense to them. And me saying that actually brings to mind the idea of like, how do we create time to do that? Like, how do we get this ball in their court, but how do we allow them to monitor their progress and self-reflect on their choice? Like those students in the kindergarten class that were choosing those tubs, just thinking back to that and like, how do we really allow them to have this conversation before that lesson ends so they really can reflect on that choice? Audrey, I think it's really something I could have done much more with my students.
Yeah, that's a perfect point. So in all of these discussions, as I'm using you as the example, it shouldn't be me trying to figure you out. It should be me offering you the choice and saying like, you figure you out. You're the one who lives with you for the rest of the life, right? This lifespan, you figure it out. I'm going to be there to help guide you with it, but like, let's have a conversation around this.
I mean, that's a life skill, right? Boy, we're raising students that can do that in life. I mean, that's the way to go. But here's the thing. I mean, I'm going to give my own yeah, but our system is not designed for teachers to have time to do this. I can think back when I tried to do it with kids, it usually fell flat because I think I didn't break apart the system enough. And as a result, it didn't feel authentic to my fifth graders. Like, it's kind of like, okay, let's reflect. It came out of left field for them. They're like, really? So like, I think they felt like it was a teacher thing to do. They didn't see it as improving and empowering them, improving their next step and making them have, just more, just more stake in the learning.
I appreciate that, Mark. I appreciate always when we're able to share with listeners like that we didn't get it right
True. True.
nearly close to all the time, or
Yeah.
anywhere close to that. It reminds me a little bit of Peter Liljedahl's work, where he talks about how, and also Deborah Ball's work, where they talk about like there's so much stuff that happens that we don't realize is communicating messages to students that make them think what they're supposed to do is answer in a certain way, right? And that confuses them almost around like what is the teacher trying to do here? Like the discretionary spaces of decision making and like
Yeah.
the what are we communicating about what to expect in a math class. And so like those to me feel like those spaces where having another set of eyes in the classroom is like the invaluable space of like what am I communicating to kids that I don't realize I'm communicating to kids, right? Like, how am I communicating to them that this is a teacher thing and not a them thing, even though I said the words that this is a them thing, right? So I just offer that, like, I really believe in having a coach is one of the best things that can make our practice grow at any stage of the game. And so it's always interesting to think about how we get another set of eyes in on that to say, like, oh, well, maybe it's because you did this, or here's how it came across, or did you realize you said that and then you did this, all of those things. So.
Oh yeah, for sure, Audrey. And even in lieu of a coach, if that's not possible, just being able to get our colleagues in our classrooms with us. I knew Robert Kaplinsky with his Observe Me hashtag, and just the idea of getting colleagues in our classrooms and saying, "Hey, I'm curious about this. Can you watch this?" And I think it's such an underutilized resource for us to be in each other's classrooms that way.
Sure.
The authors also bring up this idea of taking the medical profession and medical practices and comparing them a little bit to the teaching profession and teaching practices. And I know sometimes when we compare education to other things in the world, there can be a lot of pushback and, that's not the same and so forth and so on, which I agree it's not the same. But I think that there's some really interesting analogies because there's this idea of serving others and helping others. And I think it's kind of interesting to start thinking about like how we might compare these two professions and how do they handle the way that they improve over the years. Like an example I thought of, Audrey, is like if a parent approaches going to a school and using the idea of the analogy of like if their child was going to have an important surgery coming up and they said to themselves, when I go to the school, I see these antiquated instructional practices, much the same way. Like, how would I react if I saw antiquated practices and tools that were going to be part of the operation for my child? And I just wonder is like, I'm thinking of my own children. Like, if that was something happening at the medical level, like, I would be freaking out. Like that would just be nuts. But I wonder in the education realm, with our educational practices, that we find it hard to stop and think again and unlearn. Like, what is the difference between the two professions in their ability to unlearn things so that we're not bleeding and having leeches and, things like that? I mean, there's things we've clearly left behind in the medical world, and some of them were only like 20, 30 years ago. But the blackboard lasted 100 years. So, like, what is it about these two professions that allows them to maybe, and somebody could push back on me, maybe this isn't the same in terms of rate of change, but it feels to me that the medical profession is more nimble with change than the education profession. Just wondering about that, Audrey.
It's a good question, Mark. I've heard people share timelines of American education in several spaces, and in 200 years our technological advances have been off the charts, like when you think about them, which changes the medical field quite a bit, but should have changed the education system and hasn't drastically. So, there's so many of our classrooms that look very similar to ones that looked 50 years ago, 100 years ago. And to speak of that, one of the practices that has been around for a very, very long time is the labeling of students. And we've chatted about that a bit, but it's just interesting that like there are some things that are harder to let go of than others.
Yeah, I completely agree. Labeling is definitely one of those that just endures. It's just a real barrier for us as educators. And our profession has a long history of categorizing, sorting, and labeling students. And, you know, are we using the lens of mathematics? We as educators have long labeled students for math. But, you know, I think it's important to create change in this challenge. I think it's important to acknowledge that many times the justification for the label was from that person's vantage point was to help the student. We need our students to be learning at their level, quote unquote. But it has produced for many students the opposite result, though. It's limited potential for countless students. As we, you know, we use some form of assessment to measure some past performance and use that measure to say, this is how I'm going to predict their future potential. So that, you know, it's got us into trouble, but I think we have to sort of maybe start from a place of like, people thought it was well-intended. So then how do we break it? How do we break this notion of labels and allow people to see that although well-intended, it's producing poor results.
Yeah, I appreciate that. The authors handle that pretty well. You know, they talk about while labels might be an important aspect of identity, people are so much more complex than the labels that define them. And when we focus only on labels and not the whole person, we run the risk of having a fixed mindset or making false assumptions about the learner. And I just, you know, I know that goes back to what we were discussing earlier, that when we hold on to that in a fixed way, instead of allowing it to be a situational, conditional, contextual, you know, change, we run the risk of missing out on a lot of opportunities for our students and seeing their brilliance.
Yeah, I just want to make a point about that idea of context mattering. The authors just do a really nice job of that. On page 9, they say, when we label students in a fixed grouping, we are not considering how the context can influence the learning experience. So like take it back into math teaching and learning. Like if I look at my group of fifth grade students and I decide that some of them are not able to identify fractions yet, and I decide that those students need to be remediated instead of allowing them to access the grade level content, I can come from that place that there's something broken about the student. And in doing so, I might think I'm well-intended in sending them to go catch up, so to speak, but I could be pulling them away from the rich context, the context that might be the thing that is going to make a difference for them. And instead, I might put them in another learning environment that might be devoid of context, devoid of the rich situations, the tools, and not allow them to have that opportunity. And I think one thing that I can say I'm proud of, Audrey, that when I was working with my students in a full inclusion environment, I could see that it really benefited students to be included versus excluded. It was really about broadening the context that I provide all of my students and really making sure that my stance was that they are not broken. They just hadn't had the right context yet.
So there's one other addition in this chapter that I think would be fun for us to talk about called discrepant events. And it's about an ice cream shop.
Oh, yeah.
And the author talks about a gentleman who goes in to order some ice cream, but he chooses a dairy-free option, even though he doesn't have a dairy allergy.
Right.
And he has this moment of like, what would happen if they told me I could only have this one if I had a dairy allergy? And this pretty much reminds me of every conference lunch I've ever been to, because what I prefer to eat for lunch usually falls under the category of gluten-free or vegetarian, even though those are not actually my, like, I don't have a gluten allergy, right?
Right,
and yet,
right.
So I'm told, don't take this because we only have enough for the folks who actually have a gluten allergy. And so it's super interesting to think about that, because the difference there is something that I, you know, we've been talking about as curb cut moments, that when you think about a curb cut in a sidewalk, the curb cut was not designed for everyone. It was meant specifically for people who use wheelchairs to be able to access the street from the sidewalk and vice versa.
Right.
But everyone can use it if they want to. Like, there's nobody standing there saying, sorry, you're not in a wheelchair. You can't use this. And it's become very valuable to all kinds of people with all kinds of needs, and without, specific mobility issues, even. And I think it's really interesting how we do this over and over and over again in education, because we wait until you have a label, and then we say, because of that label, you get this, but nobody else gets this, which feels like the conference lunch versus a curb cut that says, well, gosh, this is good for you. So maybe it's good for some other folks too. So let's just make it open to the class. And if other people choose to use it, like, I don't have to use a curb cut, but gosh, it sure is nice to use one, right? Do you see what I'm saying?
For sure. I'm thinking right away of traditionally with students with disabilities who might have an IEP and how there might be modifications that are listed for that student to have in that IEP. But there's this real, at least in my experience, there's been this real angst around whether other students should be able to have some of those same modifications or opportunities. And I really think, Audrey, I really think this goes back to goals again. I think part of the confusion is sort of like the idea that we don't have the same learning goal for all of our students. And, our fifth grade goal might be to understand and explain how equivalency supports adding fractions. Like, let's just take that for an example. That learning goal can be the same for all of my students, but the means to get to that goal might look different. So, my goal is not just for you to learn what a fraction is, for me to send you away and you come back near the end of the unit and you finally know what a fraction is. The idea is that students can engage in that same grade level exploration on the way to understanding fractions. They can still be exploring equivalency and adding fractions. But Audrey, all of this has to be grounded in an underlying assumption, because I think this is another place we've got into trouble. We have to have an underlying agreement that the learning that we're after in mathematics is about thinking and reasoning, and thinking and reasoning for all students. So our supports should be in service of students thinking and reasoning, not memorizing discrete skills. And all of our curb cuts have to be in service of that. Otherwise, we're supporting students toward antiquated views of school math, which are preparing students for careers, many of them that don't exist anymore. At least those discrete skills are not entry paths into those careers anymore.
Great points, Mark. I really appreciate it. Well, to wrap us up, we had a couple of reflection questions at the
Oh, yeah.
end. Maybe you can take the first question and tell us something that
Sure.
was an aha moment for you.
Definitely, for sure. I can think of one aha moment that's coming to mind, and it's that idea of when I was in the classroom teaching full time, and I started using manipulatives more as part of my practice. And when I started doing that, I really got into it. The kids really seemed to be more motivated using manipulatives to solve problems. And I have to say, at that stage, I felt like it was about students using manipulatives to solve problems. Like that, using that tool, that was the goal. And, the fact that they could solve problems easier and they enjoyed it more. And there wasn't anything wrong with that, but that's just part of it. And then later, my aha moment was like, wait a second, the tool was more about the students understanding the larger concept of mathematics that they were studying. It wasn't just a way to solve the problem. So, kind of like the ice cream shop, that was my aha moment in teaching mathematics, Audrey.
I love it. Well, the second question asked about what was resonating with you, and I'm gonna take that one on and say the jagged learning profiles. I really appreciated it here in this text, seeing them differently than I've seen them other places, because it reminds me that those profiles change with context. So the authors offer a really cool thing. You can try it out on page 11. But I want to just give you two scenarios, and I want people to think as you listen to them, how would you feel in these two scenarios? Like, how do you think about your interest, your persistence, maybe how you're comprehending, how you're expressing what you learn, like all of those things in these two scenarios. Okay. Same goal. Both of them, the goal is going to be to learn a new language. Are you ready for this, Mark? I'll do it
Okay,
fast.
I'm ready. Okay.
Okay. First scenario, it's required for your job. They're going to
Okay.
provide you audio recordings that are
Okay.
designed for kindergartners, like pre-readers.
Ah.
Okay. But when it comes to test time, they're going to test your ability on a written assessment in about 4 weeks, and you're going to be asked to match written words with their definitions. How
Ooh.
confident are you feeling about learning a new language?
Oh, my confidence is waning. And I'm thinking I might get I just knowing myself as a learner, I'm listening to those audio recordings, I'm totally gonna fall asleep, Audrey. I'm
Yeah.
like, I'm gonna be just not engaged.
Yeah.
And so then I'm not, and then when I get to the written thing, it's gonna be so different for me. Like it's not gonna end well.
You got to hope that the spelling was in a characters that you could recognize too, right? Like that you could, right?
Yeah, one last thing, Audrey, is like required for my job. I'm gonna feel like it's kind of a compliance thing. It's
Yeah.
not gonna feel like I'm really in it to win it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's one thing I thought about this first with Spanish. I'm like, oh, not so bad. I'd be able to make sense of it. And then someone else goes, what about Chinese, Audrey? And I was like,
Ooh,
yeah, if
you
it was
gotta test.
written, I would have no idea how to read those characters. Like now I'm
Yeah,
in
right.
trouble. Now I'm in trouble, right?
Sure.
Okay, second scenario.
Okay.
Same idea, gotta learn a new language. You're traveling to a new country next month. You need to navigate from the airport to your hotel resort, whatever you want to call it, this place you're staying.
Okay.
To prepare, you're given an app that you can use on your phone. It has audio, written words, images, and you can select different contexts. So you can select, you know what I mean? You can select your kind of pathway of learning. It's designed for adults. How confident are you feeling that you might learn the language and be successful here?
Well, first, the engagement part of the things, like I have a high level of motivation and engagement because I need to be able to get from the airport to the resort. And I do enjoy travel. So that's going to be something that's already going to be something that's going to feel like I have a reason to learn it.
Yeah, I love that. So the first thing came to mind when I was reading that part, I was like, well, gosh, I could rely on spoken word, but if I'm feeling not so great about speaking the language, there's probably going to be signs I can use. There might be words I can read. Like there's going to be other tools between an airport and where I'm going that I can use too. So like my assessment of whether or not I learn the language also feels a little bit more open, right? Like I can use all the tools in my tool belt versus just matching the language. So I think this is a really interesting, like when you juxtapose situations, there's a different example in the text. So you can read that one and you can even use the profiles they have there to think about your own profile. I think it's really interesting to think about how context changes how we feel about our own Jagged profiles. Like we might be really engaged in, you could say learning a language. And you might be like, oh, yeah, I'm down for that. And then you think about the actual context of it. You think about the actual supports of it. And you're like, oh, not so engaged, right? Or hyper engaged for it. Those things change, they're variable. And so I just really appreciated that. That's sticking with me. And I'm going to keep thinking about that as we head into chapter two, I think.
I think that's great, Audrey. I think it's great to leave our listeners with something that they can just practically go try out in the classroom in terms of teaching mathematics and how that context can matter, depending on the situation. Thanks a lot for that. Thanks for joining us for this episode. In our next episode, we will chat about Chapter 2, the UDL Road Trip. Until then, what will you unlearn?